Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews professionals, donors, and thought leaders in the field of fundraising. Hello, everyone. A community is growing for us on Instagram. Please follow at devdebrief so that you can submit questions for future episodes and see images of our guests. You will hear today I include listener questions for the first time. Most recently, Kelsey Keating of the Upper East Side, longtime loyal listener, won a guessing game of one of our guests pictured in a vintage photo. In this week's episode, he is the president of an elite liberal arts college, is a scholar of the law, is leading an historic campaign, and is a parent of an alum of his institution to top it all off. Steve Poskancer, the president of Carleton College, talks about his perspective on development. A true legal brain, he explains how this informs his preparation for making asks, and I was surprised to learn of his strategy. Steve underscores the kindness of the Midwestern community, the value of a liberal arts degree, and shares two pieces of advice he learned from his mentor, Hugo Sonnenschein, the former president of University of Chicago. Prior to Carleton, President Poskancer received his undergraduate degree from Princeton University and a law degree from Harvard University. After practicing law briefly in Washington, D.C., his entire career has been spent in higher education. He first worked in the Office of the General Counsel at University of Pennsylvania. He then spent a year as an American Council on Education Fellow back at Princeton, working as an assistant to the university's provost. In 1993, Poskancer moved to the University of Chicago, where he served as executive assistant to the president. From 2001 to 2010, Poskancer served as president of SUNY New Paltz. New Paltz dramatically enhanced its student and faculty quality and its overall academic reputation during Poskancer's tenure, including being recognized by Newsweek as the hottest small state school in America.
So you are in New York City with development, is that right?
I am. I'm here talking to trustees and some potential donors. I got to make at lunch today.
Oh my gosh. So before we dive in, I would love for you to share with our listeners a little bit about Every Carl for Carleton and the current campaign that you're in.
Sure. So this is a comprehensive campaign for the college. I'll talk a little bit more about the name. We are seeking to raise at least $400 million, which for Carleton will be the largest campaign that the college has ever done. And it is a campaign that is focused on a number, but a narrow number, of objectives, all of which stem very purposely from a strategic planning effort that I did in my first couple of years at the college.
I understand that this is your first soup to nuts campaign. When you started, as you referenced, with the strategic plan, how did you know where to begin?
That's a great question. When I came to Carleton, this is now my 10th year at the college, they had just finished a campaign that had met its goal, and the college had really gone maybe about a decade to a decade and a half from the last time that it had done very thorough, very focused strategic planning. I felt that this was a good moment. People weren't ready to start a next campaign yet. Their wallets needed a little bit of time to recoup or heal. Mm-hmm. And heal. I wanted to get to know my new college well. So I consciously set out to do a very thorough, very inclusive and transparent strategic planning process. The culture of this college is such that the board would never make a decision just by itself. The faculty would never make a decision without talking with staff and students. And so I hoped from the beginning that the college would be willing, in an era of constrained resources, to make choices about what were the things that mattered the most to this college that would make it stronger for the next decade, decade and a half. And I very purposefully spent a year to a year and a half. We had 13 different working groups with 140 different people. I had board members, I had faculty, I had staff, I had students, I had alumni, I had people that were just friends of the college, including some people that we hoped someday might be major donors in the campaign. The whole idea here was to invest people in the planning process so that they would feel it was their plan And I knew perfectly well that the day was going to come where we were then going to run a campaign to pay for the things that their plan called on us to do. Mm-hmm. And I wanted my critical, likely prospects to be part of putting together the plan. And that has worked very, very well.
Well, I guess that starts answering the question around every Carl for Carlton.
It does.
So tell us about that. It's a great name.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, one of the things that this, as you mentioned, this is my first time doing a campaign, so I didn't fully understand the practical as well as the aspirational reasons for why campaigns have names. I would describe Carlton as a very close-knit, organic, cohesive community. It's not very hierarchical. There is a great deal of campus pride in the fact that it is an informal, friendly place. People who go to Carlton often call themselves Carls, so that's where that comes from. And so the idea of having a campaign name that consciously evoked the fact that all of us were connected, all of us were united in this effort for the college was what it's designed to achieve. And I think my external relations development team also was mindful of the fact that it was a utilitarian slogan that could be tailored in different ways.
Yes.
If we were talking about financial aid, you could turn every Carl for Carlton to every Carl has a dream, or every Carl cares about access, or every Carl cares about faculty. And there were lots of ways you could build off the every Carl something.
Right. And so you've been associated and worked for and attended lots of different institutions.
Yeah, I'm more of a vagabond than maybe is ideal.
Would you say that this cohesion is unusual in comparison to the other institutions you've been a part of?
Yeah, I think so. Now, I adore Carlton. It has been my favorite place that has spoken most to my heart over the course of my career. But one of the things that I love about it is the combination of superb academics with a culture that is distinctively kind and unpretentious and welcoming and warm and funny.
You must be in the Midwest.
I am in the Midwest. You know it, okay. And the Midwest is a big part of it. Yes. It's the Midwest, and then it is this sort of Minnesota version of the Midwest. For folks from the East and the West Coast, they've chosen to come to small town Minnesota, mm-hmm. and that does mean that everybody who's there wants to be there and mm-hmm. is committed to the place, and that leads to a very healthy culture.
This is a quote from you. It says, "Staying great in this millennium requires that colleges respond wisely to the necessity of change. The priorities we have set for Carlton will bolster our ability to keep faith with students, unleash the talent of our faculty, and adhere to our core values and keep Carlton truly excellent." How important is development in pursuing that excellence for Carlton?
Oh, it's absolutely central. Quality costs. And if we're going to deliver a personalized, intensive education where faculty work directly with students and are bound to them, and students are part of this small community where they really get to know each other and get to know faculty mentors, you know, about 21 to 23% of our operating expenses are covered by endowment on a regular basis.
Oh, wow.
That's low.
That is low.
Compared to some of the places that we go head-to-head against. And if I could snap my fingers and do truly transformative things at Carlton, if by the time I leave that number's much larger, I would feel like I had been a good steward to the institution. So the development piece is critical to this.
So that's one of the things on your mind when you think about your legacy. It's fixing that budget model?
Very much so.
Interesting.
And, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. I worry less about whether some other school is raising more money. I worry about whether we're connecting people to us and raising more dollars over time.
Yes. I want to shift gears and talk more specifically about development and your perspective on development.
Sure.
You've started talking about this a little bit, but where does development fit in your priorities? Because for us, especially those of us listening, our main job is to fundraise.
Yeah.
And this is one piece of a huge pie that you have. And so I'm so curious to know where it fits.
It's a very important piece of the pie, one of the central pieces. I mean, obviously, everything that I do is aimed at keeping Carlton excellent, making it stronger. Building relationships with the people that will sustain or are sustaining the college raising its profile in ways that help us recruit students and faculty, finding the resources that are, as I said a few moments ago, absolutely essential to achieving the quality and distinction that we aim for. Fundraising is critical. So I would say it's one of the two or three things that I spend the most of my time on. And of course, when we're in a campaign, the slice of the pie that becomes a fundraising external relations piece has to grow.
Well, so you had mentioned that you have an ask today for lunch. Do you like making the ask?
I do, but I've never reached a point where I'm still internally not a little nervous about it. You know, I played a lot of competitive sports when I was a kid, so there's an element of going in to make the ask, it's game time. But it probably does raise my internal anxiety about it. I don't think if you were there with me in the room, you would ever see or know the perhaps turmoil behind the calm. What's the metaphor of the ducks that are floating so placidly on the water and paddling underneath? I think I feel like one of those ducks when I'm doing it. But yeah, I do like it. When it goes well, that's a great feeling. That's like you just hit a home run.
And then when it doesn't, do you take it personally?
No, I don't take it personally. My mentor, a gentleman that I worked with for a long time, was Hugo Sonnenschein, who was the president of the University of Chicago, and he's an extraordinary academic leader and a very gifted fundraiser. Two things that he said to me have stayed with me always and made this a lot more fun. First, he said, what you're really doing is asking people to share your passion, to you're inviting them to come with you to try and achieve something that you genuinely believe in.
And otherwise couldn't do.
And otherwise couldn't do, right. And that needs to be done, and that they may be uniquely positioned to help you do that. So that makes a huge difference. That's noble. That's not creepy at all. The second thing you got to remember is I'm not entitled, Carlton's not entitled to a penny of somebody's money. Anything that they give you is a lovely thing that they've done. They've given
freely
you
given
something that was theirs. And so I might in my heart wish that they would give more than they gave, but they didn't have to give me anything. And they're choosing to do that. And remembering that, that even a smaller than dreamed of philanthropic gesture is still a philanthropic gesture, is still doing something for the college, also helps you.
It can be very easy to get, you know, disappointed as a fundraiser, getting no after no, and you have to have this kind of boundless optimism.
Now, of course, you know, I think it's probably true that as a president, I probably get the no less frequently than, you know, the I'm just trying to qualify someone, I'm just trying to see whether someone is there. By the time the meeting is set, if my team has done their job, it's queued up, right? So, you know, my batting average is going to be a little bit better by nature of the job and by nature of the wonderful work that my team has done beforehand. But, of course, there have been times where I've made an ask and the answer has been, no, I can't do it now. Of course, there have been times when I've made an ask when, you know, I'm hoping to come out at a higher level and I don't get out at that level. But I will say, and maybe this is just the wonderful work of my colleagues, or maybe it's the fantastic devotion and generosity of Carleton alumni, I've more often seen people step up and do exactly what I hope for, or even more in some cases. And if, you know, the old adage is, right, if they're saying yes too quickly, maybe I didn't ask enough, right? But I've been humbled by the generosity of people that I've seen.
So you had mentioned briefings and preparing for your meetings. Can you get detailed with me on how the chief development officer or whoever you're working with in your external relations team best prepares you when you are getting ready to go into an ask or a meeting with a prospect?
Sure. For me, I think a lot starts with my intellectual and academic background. I'm trained in law, and I began my career actually very briefly as a real estate lawyer at a big law firm in Washington, D.C. before I moved into academia. And when I was a real estate lawyer, when you walked in for a closing, I didn't want any surprises at the closing. I wanted every document done and negotiated and finished beforehand. I wanted to have every bit of a deal lined up. I still think that way. I'm methodical. I'm organized. If I'm going to walk in and ask someone to give me $5 million, I want to know exactly how I want to build the strongest case, what objections I might get or things could present themselves during. I want to kind of game that all out, be prepared for it as much as it is possible to do so. So, and I will want to have read all of the former correspondence, all of the call reports to kind of know where the history is. We will have also talked about what it is we're going to ask them for. You know, in this campaign, I'm going to be asking for an endowed scholarship. I'm going to be asking for a gift to build that science building. Am I going to be asking for them to increase their annual giving? All three of the above? What combinations of them? Mm-hmm. I will want to make certain that I think what we're asking for is most likely to resonate with them, and mm-hmm. that will be informed by my conversations with them, by my development team's talks with them, what's in the file. Once we know what we're going to ask them for and what we will target as the size of the ask, then we go into the actual preparation.
Have you ever pushed back on a topic or an
analogy? All the time.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, and sometimes I find out that I'm wrong and my team is right and I should just totally trust them. Hmm. And sometimes I'm right and they got to trust me. And very well, that definitely happens. There'll be people that I've spent time with and I know because they themselves were a scholarship student that that's what they really care about. Even though right now we really need that last $20 million for the building, that won't speak to them the same way.
And are you following, we've talked about this on other episodes, are you following your gut in that moment? Or are you following past things they've said to you?
More the latter.
Okay.
Past things they've said, stuff in the file. Your gut's there, but I'm not an improvisational person.
Right.
So once we've decided objectively what we're thinking to ask them for and for what purpose and what amount, they will set up the meeting. And before the meeting, I will get a big, long strategy memo that I like from my team. And I've got copies here, but I won't, you know, I guess our listeners cannot see them. It will summarize what we're trying to do in the meeting. With that memo in hand, what I myself will do is sit down and I will actually write out a script. Now, I don't actually use that script, okay?
Wow.
But I want to kind of lay out what is the best argument that I think I can make for this person. And that might take me an hour. I will
sometimes... Do you think you're unusual in that?
Probably.
Okay.
Okay. But it works for me.
Right,
it gets
right.
me to the place where I know I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
I will even on occasion have my development folks look at the script and tell me what they think is a weak point in the argument or what I'm missing. Then as I'm getting ready for the actual meeting, I will have internalized that script. I will have envisioned things that might go astray, things that might go in unusual directions. I will typically sit down for, you know, when we're driving in the car to the meeting or, you know, before the lunch I'm going to have today, I've got 15 minutes set aside with the development officer who's accompanying me. And I typically won't practice the script, though there have been times when I've done that. But we'll sort of talk through what we might hear, what might surprise us, and then I'm ready. Okay. And
so this may be why you're ahead in the campaign. That's what I'm wondering.
Maybe.
Is this the silver bullet?
I don't know. It works for me. I'm not sure the same strategy would work for everyone. Mm-hmm. But I really like knowing what I'm going to be asking. I want to know that I have put together what I think will be the most compelling, pluck at the heartstrings, reinforce the sentiments that would make someone most likely to give and dig deeply.
And it sounds like, too, I'm hearing you saying that it is completely tailored towards the person that you're sitting across
absolutely.
From.
Absolutely.
Completely personal.
Yeah, it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the point where I'm going and asking for a 7 or 8-figure gift, that sort of person deserves, should expect, is entitled to not a generic ask from me, but a conversation that draws upon my relationship with them, that draws upon an informed historical understanding of their relationship with the institution, that builds off of successful and impactful gifts that they've made previously, and that inspires them to do this again or do this for the first time. It's got to be tailored.
Yes. Well, speaking of tailored, you have something about you that's very unique. Your daughter went to Carleton.
Yeah.
I would love to hear from you about how becoming a parent changed your perspective on the institution and how it brought you even closer.
You know, there are things that I...
You're lighting up right now just thinking about
it. Yeah, there are many good family stories about this. And you know my daughter a little bit because I remember talking to you when she was deciding where to go to college. My daughter wanted to go to Carleton before I got named president of Carleton. And so it was a crisis in our family when I got this job because, you know, it sounds like a bad TV sitcom, daughter and father at the same college. What I found with having my daughter Jill at Carleton was that things that I read about the college that were part of our rhetoric that sounded nice, but that I secretly in my heart of hearts may have wondered whether or not they were true, really were. I'll give you a couple of examples. It is mythology at Carleton that the students do not feel competitive with one another, that they like to work collaboratively, that students do not feel that they help each other and that it's not a zero-sum game. And I thought, well, that sounds like a lovely sentiment, but come on, they all want to go to Yale Law School and the Harvard PhD program and Stanford Business School. That can't really be true, but it sounds like a nice thing to say. It's really true. Carleton mythology also holds that it's easy to make friends and classmates beyond just your own class, and that's definitely true. You know, I went to Princeton for my undergraduate work, and I'm incredibly tightly bound with members of the class of 1980. You know, I know a couple of people from 81 and 79, but really my friend group is just my class. Not so for my daughter, okay? And seeing that and watching her as an undergraduate, I came to understand that the Carleton community is less individual class year based, as important as that is, but extends beyond. And maybe most importantly, I saw that the rhetoric about bonds of mentoring that really do last a lifetime and that faculty that truly care about the students was completely true. My daughter wrote a book. She published a book when she was at college. The book is not dedicated to her mom and me. It is not dedicated to her brother. It is dedicated to three of literally five faculty members who she would not think of coming back to town without talking to those faculty members. And seeing that as a parent really changed my view and made me a much more effective advocate for those aspects of Carleton culture. I can speak with authenticity and real knowledge, having experienced that as a parent.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. And what class year was she?
She's class of 15 at Carleton, so this will be her fifth reunion.
That's
She's
exciting.
Coming back, and that's she good. Gives to the annual fund. Ah! And I'm always telling her to get her friends to do the same. So.
When we secured this meeting, I sent out a request to the Development Debrief community, letting them know that we had a mystery president on the channel. And I've chosen two of the questions that were sent in.
Oh, excellent.
To ask you.
It's like the grab bag. This is going to be fun.
Yeah. So one of them actually comes from a development officer at Harvard Law.
Okay.
Which is your alma mater.
It is one of my alma mater.
What was the training or learning curve like for you as president, specifically as it relates to development?
It started when I worked at other big private research universities, at the University of Chicago, at Princeton. I think I gave a couple of stories about that earlier. So I would have helped my presidents that I worked with prepare for or think about their development work.
Okay.
But I would not have been going on asks, and I would not have been deeply involved in the strategy. I then worked for about 13 years in public higher education in the State University of New York system, and for almost 9 of those years, I was president of the New Paltz, SUNY New Paltz campus. Mm-hmm. And certainly there, I began to learn how to do development work. I had, you know, terrific officers who worked with me. But a public institution with a less historically grounded and not as broad a foundation was useful but not complete preparation for me when I came to Carleton. I really had to learn from the senior folks on the team, talking to former presidents about their relationships with individuals, and doing it, really getting out there. There's no alternative to looking somebody in the eye and asking them to make a $5 million gift to the college. You can read about it all you want, and I read the books that they asked me to, you know, but actually out in the field was essential.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I think it's true for full-time fundraisers. And I think this was a great question, because there is no real training manual. And thinking about, you know, the CEO going out and doing it, where, again, this is one part of your job. It's funny that your answer is the same that I think a lot of other gift officers would say,
which is that you have to ask. Right. You do have to ask. And it's about people. Mm-hmm. It's about relationships. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to do this effectively and well, I need to understand first what the college's needs and aspirations are. And I need to be the most articulate, the most compelling spokesperson for the institution. Then I need to understand where this individual or set of individuals I'm meeting with are coming from. What mm-hmm. motivates them?
Right.
What is their relationship with the institution? All the wonderful staff work and the background reports and the practice sessions is necessary but not sufficient to that moment where you're really yeah. engaging with a person.
For some reason, I was expecting that you would have some other answer. But the answer is the same.
I think fundamentals are the fundamentals. It's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, our second listener question is one that I think you probably get a lot. What is the value of the liberal arts degree given today's focus on entrepreneurship and STEM?
We live in a world that's changing incredibly fast. And all the data show that, you know, somebody who graduates from college today will change jobs 6 and 7 times over the course of their life. Whatever it is you are being trained to do, whatever knowledge you are getting in your schooling is going to be obsolete. That's just the nature of the world we live in. So what is the wisest, best intellectual and career bet for a smart young person in a world that's changing that fast? Well, the answer to that is timeless intellectual skills that are utterly adaptable and translatable no matter how fast the economy is changing, no matter how fast jobs are appearing or disappearing. What do employers tell us that students and graduates need? They need to think critically. They need to be able to write powerfully. They need to be able to construct arguments. They need to be able to listen to people rip their arguments apart and construct a better argument the next time. They need to understand how knowledge from one domain is applicable in another domain. They need to understand the power of numbers and how statistics can be used or manipulated. These are the skills. Oh, they need to think ethically about their place in the world. They need to understand, in a world where artificial intelligence and algorithms are more and more important, they need to understand what is inescapably human, and to appreciate those qualities. A liberal arts education, well-grounded, broad, and capacious, gives you exactly those skills. You will be more nimble, you will be more adaptable, you will be able to play longer-term critical roles on teams by acquiring this type of education. And the data back it up. There's a Georgetown Center on the Workforce study that just came out last week that ranked lifetime return on investment for colleges and universities, and really strong liberal arts colleges were right up there with the greatest research universities in the world. This is a smart educational bet, and you can't only think about college in terms of what you're going to earn and what jobs you're going to get. Yes, that's central, and it should be, and I don't apologize for talking about career preparation at Carleton, but we are also in the business of preparing engaged citizens mm-hmm. and thoughtful leaders in society, mm-hmm. and a liberal arts education is absolutely wonderful preparation for that. And, you know, I was having a conversation the other day with the former president of Carleton, Bob Edwards, who is a dear friend of mine, who said to me, you know, now I'm retired and I now draw upon my liberal arts education every day in my readings and in the museums I go to and in the life that I lead. And he's right. A great undergraduate education feeds your soul. It prepares you to be a better person. It brings joy to your life.
I love that so much. And as someone who went to a small college, I completely agree with it and believe it wholeheartedly.
It is. And for me, it is the fundamental great career privilege that I have, is that I get to wake up every single morning and take care of an institution that delivers that type of life-changing education.
Well, thank you for squeezing us in before your ask. We're going to have to hear how that goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's primed. I'm pretty comfortable.
Well, we know you are now.
Yeah, I've prepared thoroughly, haven't I?
But I would like to end with my signature question. What do you know for sure?
I know that it's my overarching responsibility to care for the long-term health and success of my institution. And I have to take that seriously. I am playing for posterity that I will not be here to see. And
I just got chills.
I really believe that.
Yeah.
And I'll close with the thing that I alluded to just a moment ago. I know that I truly, really believe with every fiber of my being in the importance and the wonder of the institution that I work for. I love my college, and I know that. And that makes a lot of things. It makes the hard days easier. It makes the easy days more joyful. And it makes me remember how lucky I am to have a career and to be at a place that I care so deeply about.
Steve, thank you so much.
Catherine, this was a lot of fun. Thank you.